Mr. Feldman, I think maybe it'd be nice to begin at the beginning and tell me something about your early life, your childhood, and your parents, and what kind of family you grew up in.
All right. I was born in Omaha, Nebraska on September 14th, 1907. My parents were immigrants from Russia. They came from the westernmost province of Russia, known as Volhynia. And they lived in what was known in Yiddish as a shtetl, meaning a small town. As a matter of fact, I think that the first time my parents ever saw a railroad was when they left Russia to come to the United States.
Oh, really?
They lived in a little village way off the middle of nothing, I guess. They lived close to the old Austro-Hungarian border. My father was a member of a large but very poor family. I think the family made its living running an inn. And my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, was an innkeeper, which was not an unusual occupation for the Jews in the Pale of Settlement in Western Russia. My father was also a Hasid, a member of the Hasidic sect, which means that he was a member of that branch of the Jewish faith which was most emotional, most excitable, given to rather loud prayers, and not as intellectual as the more intellectual branches of the Jewish faith were. The Hasidim were also the most orthodox. Well, I wouldn't say the most orthodox, but they were certainly orthodox. In any event, my father served his 4 years in the Russian army, which was required. Then he got married. He married a woman 10 years his junior from a neighboring town, their marriage being arranged by a marriage broker. I think my father never saw my mother until he married her.
Oh my goodness.
My mother must have been a beautiful woman. I have pictures of her, of course. They go pretty far back. And I once asked my father, what if when you got to her town you discovered that the broker had misrepresented things and that you were going to marry an ugly woman, would you have married her? And he said, I think I would. It was all settled. Marriages were arranged between families. But I said, weren't you a little relieved when you found that your wife-to-be was a beautiful young woman? He said, yes, I was. Which means that my father was quite a human being. In any event, he served his 4 years. Then he got out, got married, and he had two sons quickly. And then the Russo-Japanese War broke out in 1905. And since he had no feeling of loyalty to a government that oppressed him, he, as many others did, simply headed for the border. He told me he got on a white horse and went across the Austro-Hungarian border. I might say that in those days you didn't need travel papers. Passports were unknown. You simply went about as you liked. You didn't need identification papers, and he had none. But he didn't have enough money to take mother and my two older brothers, so he came alone. This was not unusual with the early immigrants. He came to Omaha because a couple of uncles had preceded him there, and one just followed another. And he worked very hard for a year and made enough money to send for mother and the two boys. They came over on the steerage, as he did. And I gathered that that trip from this little town, this little shtetl in western Russia, to Hamburg, then to Liverpool, then in the steerage to New York, must have been a terribly difficult experience.
Certainly sounds it.
They often talked about it. And it's, of course, the immigrants' experiences have been discussed in many, many books by historians, we know. But it was a psychological burden to move from one culture to another. They didn't know a word of English when they came here. My mother didn't know many more words when she died many years later. But they came to Omaha, and I was the firstborn in Omaha. There were in all 7 children in my family, of whom 6 are still alive. There were 6 boys and 1 girl. And a brother, I was the 3rd in the line, 3rd from the top. But the next older one, Lou, died many, many years ago when I was still a student in college. So in effect, there were 6 of us over the years. And we're pretty well scattered around, but we get together once in a while. But we're very much a family. My father never had very much in the way of worldly goods. He was very religious. He was very reluctant to let me go to college. My 2 older brothers didn't even finish high school because he needed their earnings. But my father was reluctant to see me go to college because he thought it would undermine my religion. My father's culture was entirely religious and very orthodox and very old worldly. In any event, I was always a stubborn person, and since I was on my own and worked my way through, I was able to do as I pleased, and I went to the University of Nebraska.
Now, I have a question about this. Mm-hmm. 2 questions. First, what did your father do when he was in Omaha?
Oh, he was a grocer. He had a little store. He started out with a very small mom and pop sort of store, and then as the boys grew older and could help him, he graduated, and later in life he had a rather nice, rather large grocery store and did pretty well at it. He never made a lot of money, but he made a living, supported us. But we all helped too. I might add that I had the great good fortune of going to what was then regarded, and I'm certain that it was correct, one of the very best high schools in the United States, Omaha Central High School. It was a famous high school in those days, very high standards. I've always believed, I still believe, that the high school years are critically important years for a young person's educational and cultural development. And it was my great good fortune to go to a first-class high school. I think I learned more there than I learned in college. I had 4 years of Latin, 4 years of English, 4 years of history. It was real good, solid stuff. None of this badminton, beginning and intermediate badminton or anything like that. I went to the university. I graduated from high school in 1925. It was a big high school. My graduating class probably had 600 people in it. And I went to the University of Nebraska.
Now, why did you, is it because of the high school that you think you went to the university when you're parents had not this kind of education and your brothers didn't go?
Well, I would not say that my father discouraged me from going, although I think I would have gone anyhow, but I'm merely saying that he didn't encourage me to go. It was not his idea. He didn't say to me, well, you must go to college and get an education.
But why did you want to go when your brothers
didn't? I just enjoyed going to school, I guess. I had a fine high school record. Gee, I hope I don't sound boastful when I tell you that in my 4 years in high school, and this was one of the most demanding high schools in the country, I had all A's.
Great.
It was a good record, yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It just was expected. And then I was a member of the state championship debating team, and I won the state extemporaneous speaking contest my senior year. So everybody thought, as I did, that I'd just have to be a lawyer since I was a good public speaker. So I went to the university, and I went to the University of Nebraska because somebody came in from Lincoln to interest me in going there. I had never thought I could afford to leave home, and there is a university in Omaha, a Jesuit school known as Creighton University, and it has a law school, and many Omaha lawyers were graduates of Creighton. That's where I intended to go, but at the last moment I was offered a job because a new fraternity was starting up. They needed some pledges, so this was a fraternity for Jewish boys.
At Nebraska.
In Nebraska. And the rabbi of the conservative synagogue in Lincoln, who was interested in the group, came in and offered me a job teaching in his religious school. I had a very good religious training. I went to what we call Hebrew school, which is a school after the public school is over, through age 15. So I, as a matter of fact, read the whole Old Testament in the original Hebrew, and I was well into Talmud by the time I quit. So I had a pretty good background. I had enough background to teach youngsters how to read the prayer book. So that's how I worked my way through college. I taught every afternoon and Sunday mornings in their Sunday school at the conservative synagogue in Lincoln. And it was very convenient. I taught from 4 to 6, which means I could take a normal course of a normal program of courses at the university, since there are not many classes that meet after 4 in the afternoon. And that saw me through 4 years of college. I always had a sense of guilt about making my living that way, because I never thought I knew enough to teach Hebrew and related subjects, but in any event, I was in no position to be a chooser. These were times of great economic distress, and I was lucky to get any job at all, but it saw me through college. I majored in political science. I went there with the intention of being a lawyer, and after 3 years of arts and science work, I went to the law school in Lincoln at the University of Nebraska. I had a full year of law, the first year of law, which I did not enjoy at all, and I simply changed my mind. Since I had always enjoyed political science, in which I took my major, I went back to do graduate work in political science. And I remember writing a letter to my father telling him, he was in no position to advise me, I simply told him, that I had changed my mind and that instead of being a lawyer, I think I'll try to have a career in teaching.
And was he disappointed?
My brothers told me afterwards that that was probably the happiest letter he ever received.
Oh, you mean from your point of view?
From my father's point of view, you must understand that an immigrant like my father, with his background, tended to regard the word lawyer as synonymous with the word crook.
Oh.
In his opinion, in his judgment, this is a typical peasant attitude, that he regarded lawyers as a pack of crooks. And on the other hand, he had great respect for teaching and for scholarship. And so my brothers told me that I really made him about as happy as I could when I wrote that fateful letter and told him that I switched over into teaching rather than to stay in law. But I didn't enjoy the law. I did well in law school. Courses aren't particularly difficult, but and my grades were high, but I just didn't think I wanted to spend my life doing that kind of work. So I pulled out and took my degree in 1929, my BA degree, with Phi Beta Kappa honors. Then I took a master's degree, and I had the good fortune, I wrote a master's thesis, then required. I wrote it on state constitutional law, the constitutional law of Nebraska, in fact. Indeed, the subject was due process of law in Nebraska. And I guess it was a pretty good job. It was better than my PhD dissertation, I might say. And the editor of the Nebraska Law Journal, who was a law professor, saw my thesis, or at least I showed it to him, and he liked it so much that he published the whole thing as four full-length articles. So I guess that when I went away to Yale for my PhD work, I already had about 200 pages in print, which was a pretty good start for a young man. It gave me a feeling of security and that I could do the work.
Now, why did you choose Yale for graduate
PhD? I spent 1 year on an MA and got my master's degree in 1930, and then I stayed on. The University of Nebraska was political science department was very short-handed, and they needed somebody to teach elementary courses. So I was an assistant instructor, which is about the lowest creature in the educational world, for 1 year. I remember I taught 9 hours, 3 courses each semester, large enrollments, no reading help of any kind, and they paid me the magnificent sum of $900.
For the year.
For the whole year. Yeah, they didn't throw their money around. But I taught 1 year, and then I knew that I didn't think a Nebraska PhD, which I could have had for the asking, would be worth the bother, and I wanted to go to a quality school. Well, that was 1931, and we were into the Depression, and I just had to have a fellowship. My choices were first Harvard, second Chicago, and third Yale. And while I got cordial letters from the chairman of the departments at Harvard and Chicago, they said they just didn't have any money. If I'd come there on my own for a year and make a record, maybe they could take care of me my second year. But Yale, which was way down on the list, was really Yale's political science department, which is now very eminent, was a very poor department in those days. But they did make an offer of a university fellowship for the magnificent sum of $600. And they took $325 back for tuition.
What did you live on?
Well, I borrowed from my older brother, who had a store and who was in business for himself, and he was very nice about helping me. I repaid him later on. And I also taught in the religious school of a downtown synagogue in New Haven. And I had 3 years there. I had a university fellowship my first year. And then my second year I had a good fellowship known as a Bloch Fellowship, B-L-O-C-H. He was a rich money bag from Philadelphia, as I recall, that gave Yale some money. In my third year I had a Sterling, which is, I guess, like a Vilas here. So I had a Sterling Fellowship my third year. And so my second and third year I made enough to live on. I married, I got married at the end of my second year in New Haven to Sarah Dinion. And she insists that I always make it clear that she spells her name S-A-R-A, as no H, D-I-N-I-O-N. She was one of 5 children, and when I met her she was teaching school in a public school in New Haven and had been teaching for several years. And it was from this life that I rescued her by marrying her. In any event, we were married during my dissertation year, which was my third year. Then there was a problem of getting a job, and there weren't any jobs in 1934 when I got my PhD. And the only offer I had was from my old school from Nebraska. They needed an instructor.
They were still short-handed.
Oh, yes. And they knew me, and I knew them, so that's the job I took. And I went out there in 1934, taught 12 hours each semester, large classes, no reading help, no assistance of any kind, and my opening salary was $1,500, which was pretty rough. It wasn't a lot of money, even though things were much cheaper then. And my wife stayed on in New Haven, moved in with her parents, and she taught for that year, my first year. She taught in New Haven and saved her money. We didn't even have enough money to bring out our furniture, which our belongings, to set up house in Lincoln. So we were separated for a year, except that I saw her during the Christmas recess. And then she came out the next year, and we got an apartment and set up house. And while I never made much money. It was very important during the bottom of the Depression to have some job. It really didn't matter an awful lot whether they made a lot of money or not, because some job with some salary coming in was just desperately important. And I always had a position. We didn't suffer. We lived modestly. It took us 7 years before we could afford a used Chevy, our first car. And we waited 7 years for our first child. But we always had a decent roof over our heads, and we didn't starve, and we had a very pleasant life. Lincoln is a very attractive town. It's very much like Madison. Same size, white collar, state capital, state university, very much alike. The only thing is that Lincoln doesn't have any hills, and they have an artificial pond now, but we had no water then either. But I stayed in Lincoln for 13 years, and my promotions there were very, very slow. I had a problem with my department head, who was deeply prejudiced against me, I think because of my religion. In any event, nobody cared much for him. My promotions were very slow. It took me about 8 or 9 years, I recall, before I became an assistant professor. Promotions were slow during the Depression, generally speaking. And then later on, I was made an associate professor with tenure. This is as far as I got at the University of Nebraska. In 1942, we'd gone to war, and the department here in Madison at the University of Wisconsin just fell apart. Most of the members of this department left, but there were still students, and they needed people to teach them. And I was invited to come here as a visiting professor for 1 year. I and another friend of mine, a friend of mine who was teaching, Jasper Shannon, who was teaching at the University of Kentucky and who had a Wisconsin PhD. Jasper and I came here in 1942, and I taught for a year. And then 2 years later, when the war was over and the students, the GIs began to stream back into college, the University of Wisconsin went on a three-semester plan for a short time, which means they had a summer semester, not a summer session, but
a full semester.
Full semester. Began around September 1st, June 1st, and ended around September 1st. And I was invited to come in and teach in that summer semester. That must have been the summer of 1946, I think. And then I remember by then I had two children. We had a daughter in Lincoln in 1940, and our son was born in 1943 at Madison General when we were here during that visiting year. As we were driving back to Omaha and crossing the state of Iowa, I said to my wife, well, we're never going to do this again. If we ever make this trip, it'll be for good or not at all. We had traveled back and forth twice. But shortly after I got back, I was invited by letter to come back here as a professor. And since they knew me and I knew them, I didn't come in here for the usual interviews. There was nothing to learn.
Didn't have to make that trip for
No. So I simply waited until I got a telegram telling me that the regents had confirmed the appointment. I resigned my position at Nebraska and came here in the fall. Well, it was in the summer of 1947. And what? I remember vividly that summer. It was the hottest summer I had ever lived through. I thought it would never end, incidentally. That terrible heat continued. We came here in August, and it continued through September and October and well into November. Mm. It was a very, very hot summer.
I'd be interested in knowing what recommended the University of Wisconsin to you, why you decided to leave Nebraska.
Oh, the decision to come here was probably the easiest decision I ever made. I don't think I even gave it 5 minutes of thought.
Why?
Well, because this is a very distinguished university. Mm. And in fact, I would say that coming here, which was the result of an accident that somebody in the department whom I had known at Nebraska was teaching here. I'm sure he put up my name.
Who was that?
And that was Harold Stoke.
Harold Stoke.
Yes, too. Harold W. Stoke. He died just a couple weeks ago. Harold was a professor. He was a colleague of mine in Lincoln. We were very good friends. And in 1942, he was a professor of political science, and he was E.B. Fred's assistant graduate dean. E.B. Fred was the graduate dean, and Harold was the assistant dean. And I'm sure when they had a department meeting, there was wondering whom to invite, that Harold must have recommended me. So that gave me a chance to get my foot in the door, and when a real position opened up here, they thought of me and already knew me. So, but no, that decision was didn't cause any pain at all. It was a very easy decision to make. The University of Nebraska is a nice place, and we did not have a bad life there. But it's not a first-rate school, and it isn't a first-rate school today. Its chief claim to fame is in football. And although actually during my years there we had a pretty fair political science department. It was really quite good. I think it was much better then than it is today. The people who gave it as quality have all gone to their respective rewards. I think I'm the only one still alive. Harold Stoke was the last one to go. But we had a rather strong department. But as you probably have learned, many professors have come here from Nebraska. Dave Cronin is an example. We had a librarian here who was the Nebraska librarian, Gilbert Doan.
Oh, yes.
Who was here for many years.
He was involved in the archives early on.
Yes, and then Bob Reynolds in history came from Nebraska. And there was a very popular professor of comparative literature, I forgot his name, who came here from Nebraska. And John Hicks, the famous historian, came here from Lincoln. So there's been a continuous hemorrhage of faculty people from Nebraska to Wisconsin. And, the University of Nebraska was one step on the academic ladder, but it was not near the top. So I've never regretted coming here. I think it's the best single thing that ever happened to me professionally.
Well, from the fact that you stayed here until retirement suggests that you weren't unhappy here.
Oh, there's no suffering in being a member of this faculty, and it was a great joy to come here. And I had the added experience of helping to develop or redevelop a department that had fallen apart as a result of the war years, and we really started from scratch. We have about 35 people now, but I think when I came here we had only 7 or 8 in all. And as I came here, our two of our best people, Bill Ebenstein, left to go to Princeton, and John Goss, who was a very prominent person on this faculty, left to go to Harvard. And Frederick Austin Ogg, O-G-G, after whom Ogg Hall is named, was an old man, almost ready to retire. So the department had a lot of rebuilding to do almost from scratch. We started out with very few veterans, and Bill Young, or William H. Young, came here just a few weeks before I did, and Jim McCamey came the year before I did, and then I came, and so I had a hand as a professor in helping to develop what I think has become a very strong department. We always rate for whatever the ratings are worth. Our department almost invariably rates among the top 10 in the country. And it was an interesting experience to have a hand in the recruiting of a strong faculty for this department. And that's been a source of great pleasure to me. The other great advantage of Wisconsin over Nebraska is, of course, the fact that we do serious graduate work here. We were authorized to give PhDs in Lincoln, but during all the years I taught there, we never gave a PhD.
Not one.
I always thought if a student was any good, he ought to get a PhD in a school that had more prestige. If he wasn't any good, who wanted him? So during my long stay there, 13 years, we never had one. There have been a few Nebraska PhDs since I left, but I have always disapproved of a weak department like that giving PhDs. You don't have much when you have it. This sounds a little snobbish, but there's that aspect to academic life that we can't ignore. But I had a lot of PhDs, especially in my early years here, among the returning GIs, who did very good work and who made places for themselves in higher education, and whose successes have given me a great deal of satisfaction.
Now, when along in there, I noted some point that you taught in a GI school in Florence. How did that come about? Was this in this period of time?
Yes. When the shooting stopped in Europe, the Army set up what we call GI universities, largely just to keep the boys busy while they were being regrouped and retrained for the war in the Far East, which was still going on. So they had one school in England at Chivenham, and one in France at Biarritz, and they had a third school.
I was in Lincoln at the time, and just out of the blue, somebody called me from the War Department and asked if I would like to fly over to Florence and teach the GIs in this GI school, or GI University as we called it. I think I was invited because a friend of mine had already been invited, the same Jasper Shannon that I mentioned before, who was already recruited since he had been living in Washington and had access to the people who made the appointments. In any event, I had to leave my family, and I flew over alone, and that was in the summer, late summer of 1946. And we had a school with about 2,500 students at a time. These were soldiers who were flown in from various posts in the Mediterranean area. They came all the way from Gibraltar to Cairo. And I think they were brought there as a sort of reward for good behavior. And it was really a rest and recreation experience more than an educational experience. They came for a month. Each student had 4 weeks with us. And we gave them every class met every day. So I taught a class, I remember, 11 o'clock every day. That was my teaching load. I taught a course on American government. One semester I taught a little course on constitutional law. The students, we were required to take roll, and three unexplained absences, and they went back to their outfits. I mention this because that was the best attendance I'd ever had in my life. One of the curious things about teaching at the University of Wisconsin is the poor attendance. You get used to the empty seats, but there's a cavalier attitude about coming to class, and in the last 10 years of my teaching here, I didn't even bother to take roll. I don't think very many professors take roll anymore. I think it's unfortunate, but that's how things have developed. But I certainly had good attendance in Florence. But at the end of 4 weeks, all our students were sent back to their outfits, and we had a week free to pot around. 1 week we spent in Rome, 1 week we spent in Bologna. The Army was very nice to us. And then we'd get a new student body.
Start all over.
And we start over. And I taught, the school folded up in December, as I recall, December 46. And I was transported back to the United States on an aircraft carrier called the Randolph. It was a major aircraft carrier. We sailed out of Naples, and it carried, it was used as a troop carrier, much to the annoyance of the sailors. But they packed some 6,000-7,000 returning GIs in the flight deck, in the deck below the flight deck, the hangar deck of the plane. It was an enormous ship. And that's how I came back to the United States. I remember it was a very stormy crossing, and I was the only one in my part of the ship that wasn't seasick. don't know.
How do you account for that?
I'm not really a very good traveler. I just managed to get by. One morning I went down for breakfast. I was the only one there. But that was my so-called GI University experience. We gave exams. We had textbooks, we gave exams,
and we made a record of their grades, and some American universities allowed some credit for that work. It would be up to each individual school whether it would pay attention to it, but it's my impression that most schools gave some credit to the GIs who had a record of grades in our program in Florence. But it was easy work. I only taught one course a day. They were really overstaffed when I got there. And I taught a class at 11 every day, and then the rest of the day I spent sightseeing.
Well, Florence is a nice place to be.
I went sightseeing every day for 4 months, and I must say there are many things I haven't seen yet in Florence, and I've been back twice since then. So it's one of the world's great cities. And the heart of the old city is just a great outdoor museum. Don't even have to go into a building. It's a wonderful, wonderful city.
Well, then you came back and began your serious career here at the
Well, I was serious before I left, but...
Oh, you had started before you left.
Yeah, I started in 47. No, I beg your pardon. No, I came here. The following year I came to
I was wondering about
that's right.
the dates. That
well, all I'm trying to say is that I was serious at Nebraska.
Oh, I didn't mean you weren't serious. I mean,
I began my Wisconsin career the following year when I came here and began teaching in September 1947. And I think my great good fortune here was that many years later I was given a Vilas chair, and I had the Vilas chair for my last 15 years.
15?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good long time.
Well, you have to hold a Vilas chair 15 years to be eligible for a Vilas pension, which I now have.
I didn't know there was a Vilas pension.
There's a Vilas pension. It's provided for in the will, but you have to hold the chair 15 years. I've often warned the chancellor that no one should be appointed to a Vilas professorship if he's over 55.
Otherwise
because
he
won't make the pension and he'll be sore about it.
That's quite true.
Well, it was, it certainly sweetened up my life here. The Vilas chair meant that I had light teaching loads, lots of free time to do my scholarly work. I could have, and I think the greatest single advantage of a Vilas chair was that I had money to pay for a part-time secretary of my own. Professors badly need secretarial help. And it was a great, and I had the good fortune of having a very fine young woman working for me all 15 years. And I didn't need a full-time secretary. I didn't generate that much work, but I certainly made use of half-time. And there was enough money for many years to hire an assistant as well, who I used mainly as a paper reader and helped me with my big course. But that was a nice bonus, which I enjoyed for my declining years at the university.
Well, I was wondering, looking at your publications and your committee work and all, how you managed to do all that, and I can see this
well,
has been a big asset.
I was a very busy man, and I think, I don't want to sound boastful, but I think I worked at my job. I always wanted to be a participant. I never was happy to be a bump on a log, and if I was going to be a member of this faculty, I wanted to be an active member, and I had a great deal of interesting positions or chores or functions to perform during my years at Wisconsin. Would you like me to summarize?
Summarize, and then I might like to go into details on some.
All right. Well, let me see. I was elected to the university committee, which is our prize committee, for a three-year term in 1960, I think it was. And during my third year, I was chairman of the university committee. I regarded that as one of my best years. I think the chairman of the university committee has a wonderful experience. Ed Young often told me that his year as chairman of the university committee was the high point of his career at Wisconsin. And while I can't say that for myself, because in those days, the university committee wasn't nearly as busy as it is now. And in fact, during my chairmanship, the only serious question we had to settle was whether we should accept the Rose Bowl invitation. And
that was a big issue at that time.
It was a big issue, but since the six of us would have been lynched if we had said no, we had no real choice but to tell President Harrington that, in our opinion, as long as we're a member of the Big Ten, we should accept our responsibility, as one responsibility being that whoever wins the title, who has the number one spot in the Big Ten, goes to the Rose Bowl against the first team on the West Coast.
Well, this issue had come up before, I think, too.
Well,
first time around?
That was the first time we had a Rose Bowl invitation. But President Harrington, who was a very shrewd operator, didn't want to accept the onus of accepting that invitation on his own responsibility. And he didn't want a special meeting of the faculty to haggle over it. And so he simply, and there wasn't time for a faculty meeting, so he merely asked me to convene the university committee and to advise him whether he should accept the invitation. So of course we advised him to take it, but I don't think we had any real choice in the matter. But that was the big event of the year, nearly as I can recall. The other big event was that during an earlier part of my service on the university committee, the university medical school dean got into trouble with his faculty, and there was a great to-do about...
Which dean was this?
I forgot his name. He was
several.
Well, he was really let go. He took his case to us, and we were involved, but there wasn't much we could do about it. And
you don't mean Middleton, do you?
No. It was the first dean after Middleton. He was a short fellow, I remember. Forgot his name.
We can check that.
Yeah, but he had a great run-in with the the surgery department, as I recall. And Tony Carreri and he were at each other's throats. But we were involved, but although there was not much we could do and there's not much that we accomplished, but we did get involved. But in those days, being on the university committee wasn't a very time-consuming chore. Even the chairman of the university committee was largely concerned with symbolic and symbolic events. I represented the faculty. For example, when we had the dinner for the new president, President Harrington, I was on the speaker's table as chairman of the university committee, simply because somebody had to be up there to represent the faculty. That sort of work went with the job. But it was, nowadays, it's a terribly time-consuming and very demanding job, but it wasn't in the early 60s when I was there. Well, later on, I got involved when I left the chairmanship of the university committee. I wrote President Harrington a letter, and I told him that it was about time that the university had a decent set of rules and regulations, that Alden White, our perennial secretary of the faculty, had done his best to gather together whatever rules he could dig out from the regents' minutes and faculty minutes, and he had a so-called red book that was used, but it was a hopeless compilation of things. Many of the provisions there were no longer followed. Much of it was obsolete. I always thought a well-run university ought to have some well-established rules, at least on things that matter to the faculty. I advised him that he ought to set up a committee to codify the rules, restate and modernize, which is what we mean by codification, the rules and regulations of the university faculty. And as I should have anticipated, but didn't, his reply was, "That's a good idea, I appoint you chairman," which taught me the price of opening your mouth as you get involved. And he appointed several people to work with me that I had recommended. And then I asked him to have a member of his staff serve on the committee with us so that there'd be some liaison with the president's office.
Do you remember the members of the committee?
I remember Don Percy was the... He was on the president's staff, and Don often told me that he first learned the rules of the university through this experience with us. Abner Brody of the law school was on the committee, and what's his name? He left us and went to the University of Washington. Vernon Carstensen.
Oh yes.
In the history department was a member of the committee, and. My memory is now running out of names. There were at least two more. Oh, there was another law professor who's recently left. I don't remember his name. John Conway. John Conway had been for many years the statutory reviser downtown in the Capitol building, and of course he was very valuable for his expertise in phrasing concepts in general terms. I think that was about it. It was a small group. Mm-hmm. It was kept small so that we could meet frequently. And we worked very hard. We worked for about 4 years, I recall. I would say roughly from about 6 years. Roughly from 1964 to 1970. The president asked me if we would make our first order of business the restatement of the rules with respect to tenure, the faculty tenure, academic freedom, and faculty dismissals. And that's what we worked on first of all. And our completed work was submitted to the regents, and the regents were very enthusiastic about our rules, which are really model rules. They've been copied all over the country. And in fact, I got a formal letter of commendation from the Board of Regents for our work on the faculty tenure rules. These rules are still in the rules and regulations, though they've been touched up several times since then by later codifications.
That was my impression, that sometime in the late 70s there was something done about this.
Yes. There was an overhaul of the rules not very long ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, as I recall. But I think rules are always subject to change, and there are some changes now pending with respect to some aspects of the faculty committee system that are now pending before the Faculty Senate. One of the institutions we created, our committee created, was the Committee on Faculty Rights and Responsibilities, so-called R&R Committee, which has now become a terribly busy committee listening to appeals from a denial of promotion to tenure. And there's some legislation pending to take some of the enormous burden off of the committee by at least permitting it to sit in panels so that not all eight of them have to sit on every case all the time. But I was elected, it's an elected committee, and I was elected to the first Committee on Faculty Rights and Responsibilities and was re-elected once, and I served as chairman. I think I was chairman for about 6 years. But we had nothing to do. We had no case at all. The business of that committee came later.
If there wasn't this much to do, why was it felt necessary to have such a committee?
The original idea of the R&R committee was to have some committee available to protect professors who were subjected to disciplinary measures short of dismissal. For dismissal, we had already worked out a very careful set of procedures, but there was nothing for disciplinary actions taken short of dismissal. That was the original idea. Later on, and I thought it was proper, the R&R committee was made the hearing committee for dismissals as well as for other disciplinary cases. And its powers were further extended by other legislation dealing with the denial of tenure, so that it's become a very important and very busy committee. But in my day, we were required by the written rules to report to the faculty every year. My report was each year, I was happy to say that we had nothing to do, and we never did meet, and we never did anything. That's my idea of a good committee, is one that does
not have any work. Well, of course, the faculty, early on anyway, wasn't anything like as large as it is today, was it? So.
No, and
but it was growing, of course.
And there's a certain tendency towards litigation, which has developed throughout the country in higher education, which goes back only about 10, 12 years. And this tendency to fight for your rights, which is altering the face of faculties around the country.
How do you think this has evolved? Why do we think this?
Well, I suppose faculties, professors are like other people. They don't enjoy feelings of helplessness, and when they're in trouble, they want to be judged by their peers, and they want to be judged according to some fair procedure. And the whole tendency of our rules and regulations has been to assure due process, what we call academic due process, for professors on those things that happen to them that matter to them, such as the imposition of discipline or dismissal or denial of tenure or anything else which is considered to be negative from the professor's point of view. And we've gone pretty far here, because faculty opinion has always been unusually important at Wisconsin. We have more faculty self-determination and more remedies vis-a-vis administrators than are available to most faculties in around the country. I know I was busy, I shall come to it in a moment, for many years with the American Association of University Professors, and I have spoken about academic governance problems all over the country, and whenever I'd tell a college president, well, at Wisconsin, this is the way we do it, I always get the same answer. The president would throw up his hand and say, oh, Wisconsin isn't like the rest of us. There's something special about that school. I think from a point of view of faculty involvement in their own fate, this is an unusual school. That there are very few quality universities where faculty opinion is as significant and as decisive as it is here.
Well, I think this is what Dean Ingram has referred to as what he calls faculty governance.
Yes.
And it's been my impression that Wisconsin prides itself on this.
Yes, indeed, and has every reason to. There are very few schools that do are as thoroughly committed as we are to peer review and peer judgment, which means that we're not at the daily mercy of administrators. And that has the advantage, I think, that it reduces the perennial state of warfare which exists on many campuses between professors and administrators. I think we get along better here.
Well, Richard was telling me something about this, about a situation where a group of people were sitting around a table, and it turned out that younger men were grumbling about or complaining about something about the administration, and it turned out that they'd never been anywhere else.
That's right, and it's quite true that there are many people on our faculty who do not realize how well off they are, because they have nothing to compare their experience with. They'd only get around. I've often said that when I go on a trip to other campuses, when I come back here, I want to get down and kiss the ground on which this university stands, because it's a good place in which to live and to teach. Now, one of my long range activities, I got into it, I forgot how I got into it, was my long service on the Honorary Degrees Committee. I was appointed to the committee in 1966, I think by the president of the university, and I remained on the committee until I retired. That was in 1979, so I had a long service. And I was chairman of the Committee on Honorary Degrees from 1971 to 1979, till I retired. And I rather enjoyed that. I enjoyed having a hand in selecting our candidates. I enjoyed helping entertain them when they came here, and I enjoyed presenting them at the annual commencement.
Would you tell me a little bit about how you went about your work of finding honorary degrees?
Well, the Committee on Honorary Degrees is the largest committee we have here in terms of members. The president appoints, as I recall, 10 people, and he usually puts a few deans on it, which I think is a good idea. And each divisional committee elects several. It's quite a large committee. It has about 25 or 30 members. I'd have to, it's all spelled out in our rule book. And an awful lot depends on the chairman. He has to assemble the material and digest it and present it to the committee in an understandable way.
By material, you mean?
Well, when a department recommends somebody for an honorary degree, they submit supporting data. Bibliography, a vita, some account of the person's life. The idea of the honorary degree is to confer an honor, to confer public recognition upon someone who did something which is of great value to society. I never believed that the honorary degree should be limited merely to academic people. I always thought, for example, that a person who had a long honorable career in the legislature, or a person who served as well as governor, might well have an honorary degree. I got into a lot of trouble with some of my academic colleagues on precisely that ground, that they thought that politicians are lowly creatures who don't deserve that honor. It always annoyed me. It seems to me that public service in the legislature or as governor is an honorific sort of service, and that it was quite proper to recognize and express our gratitude to people who had been important figures in the state government. The message I always got from the regents was that they didn't want to limit our honorary degrees to academic people, to other professors. And they were always very pleased when we'd recommend a man who had a great career in business or in law or medicine or some other profession. And I agreed. I thought that the honorary degrees should not be limited to honoring people like ourselves who are professors in other schools. We are limited here in Wisconsin by the rule that, although there are some rare exceptions, that we will not award an honorary degree unless the individual has had some connection with the University of Wisconsin or with the state of Wisconsin. So we're not free simply to look around and simply pick a distinguished person and ask them to come here and get a degree.
You don't have a whole country at your beck and call.
No, we don't. We're limited to. Now, we construe that very loosely, and several times we were at the margins of the rule, but that has been our way of doing things. It's written into our rules and has always been the case so far back as my memory goes. But that took a lot of my time over the years and was sort of an interesting little hobby that I had developed. I
spend many years on it. Kind of miss the experience now. I served 1 year as chairman of the Committee on Nominations, which is an elected committee. That was in 1964. That's a very important committee because in this big faculty, you don't get on a committee or even a chance to be elected to a committee unless you're nominated by the nominating committee. So that, in effect, the nominating committee chooses most of our committee members. And the faculty functions largely through the instrument of committees. So that was an important assignment, though I had it only 1 year. People are rarely elected to the Committee on Nominations more than once. For a while, when President Harrington was in charge, we had an experiment with a faculty assembly which represented all the units of the university system. There were six chancellors under Harrington. We had a unified system here before Governor Lucy forced a merger upon us of all the colleges, public colleges of the state. But in Harrington's early days, we had
there were four, at least.
Well, there was a university here, there was one in
Milwaukee.
There was Extension with the chancellor, there was a center system with a chancellor, and there was Green Bay with a chancellor, and there was
Parkside.
There were six chancellors. And while we had a faculty here to speak for us, we did not have a system faculty. And since it was impossible to have an effective system faculty, though theoretically any member of any one of these six units could come to a faculty meeting, it was very unusual for anyone in Milwaukee to come all the way to Madison.
The professors in Milwaukee, for example, were very reluctant to make the long drive to Madison just to attend a faculty meeting, most of which didn't deal with very important matters anyhow. But since I thought that there ought to be some faculty input at the system level, this was before the merger we now have, through my codification committee, we wrote a statute setting up a university system assembly. It was, in effect, a faculty senate for all six units. It was membership was roughly apportioned to the size of each of the six faculties, so that a majority, I think, of the members of the faculty assembly were from Madison. It turned out to be a mistake. The faculty assembly was not a successful body, and it gradually simply died. No one ever killed it. We stopped calling it.
Could you explain why it wasn't successful?
It wasn't successful because it didn't have enough to do. There isn't enough system-wide business, which is a faculty concern. The main function, I think, of the system president is to deal with the governor and the legislature with respect to the budget. This is not a faculty function. We were in no position to be of any help. And it turned out that the assembly meetings, after the excitement of one or two, simply petered out. The kind of faculty business that faculty should be concerned with is a little more local and not system-wide. This is what we learned. That's why, since merger, we've been very reluctant to set up a university system-wide senate. We have no such body. And the president of the university system today has his problems in communicating with the various faculties because he doesn't have an agency through which he can communicate conveniently. So, and then it was my idea, I don't want to sound boastful, but reorganizing the university faculty was on my mind, and as chairman of the codification committee, I was in a position where I could influence events. It was my thought to set up a faculty senate for Madison. And I wrote the original statute
creating the faculty center. Now it was worked over at many general faculty meetings, but it was basically on my initiative.
Will you tell me something about your thinking? You said you've been thinking about this. Why you felt that this was a good step to take?
Well, I observed during my many years here, I went to faculty meetings regularly as a matter of duty, I guess. I observed that if the faculty didn't have very important things to discuss, very few people came. With over 2,300 faculty people invited, there were many meetings that had no more than 15 or 20. So that, on the other hand, if in a period of great excitement, as during the years of upheaval over the Vietnam War, we had faculty meetings that filled the student union. And they were almost as bad as the tiny ones. You can't have a decent meeting with 1,000 people packed into a big hall. And the floor on those huge meetings was simply taken over by the show-offs and the people who like to talk to large audiences. And a faculty meeting of 1,000 is not a deliberative assembly. So that the turnout was either too small or too large, too small to be representative and too large to be effective. And so I thought if we had a representative system and elected senators, that they could speak for all of us. I was surprised at the amount of resistance I ran into. I had always assumed in my naivete that if anybody is familiar with representative institutions, it's Americans. We've had representative institutions at all levels of government all through our history. But there were many professors who were very, very reluctant to give up their right to attend a faculty meeting if that's what they were of a mind to do.
Even though they might not have been going to many.
Yes. They wanted the right to go. I forgot to make another point. Another objection to the old faculty system, the come-if-you-like system, was that it was a sure way of any determined minority having its way. You simply called out your troops. I remember when the dean of the College of Agriculture wanted to change the name of the college to its present name. He had his troops there. I looked around, I saw people there I had never seen before. But he had, through his assistant deans, had drummed up his faculty, and they were all there to make sure they'd have their way.
Would this have been found?
It was
before him.
It was, I guess, bound. Yes, I think it was bound. But in any event, there were objections to calling it the College of Human Resources, and some people thought that sounded a little puffed up. In any event, the old system was a guarantee that any determined minority could have its way by simply turning up, by coming out. I remember on another occasion the physical education people, and there are a lot of them, all turned up. I forgot what the occasion was, but there was something they wanted, and they had their way because they were there. So that how the faculty would vote would depend on the happenstance of who happened to drop in. And this troubled me a great deal. I didn't think that was the way representative institutions should, legislative institutions should function. But we set up, the faculty had many long and anguished meetings to set up the Senate.
Now, was there a committee working on this?
It was my codification committee.
The same committee.
We kept working on it, yeah. We wrote the statute and then brought it to the faculty, and it was changed. I lost about three battles in the course of that long struggle over the Senate. My major disappointment was that I wanted the deans to be ex officio members of the Senate. I always thought that the deans are important resource people here who ought to be at a Senate meeting because of what they know. They have more command of the facts than most people do. But on the other hand, I thought that no dean who had any sense would offer himself to an election because that would put his career on a referendum basis, and
That would not be a very intelligent thing to do, to ask the faculty. We just don't run that kind of a system of responsible government. But I thought the deans should not be required to go through the hazards of elections that they might lose. On the other hand, I thought they ought to be there, so I wanted them to be ex officio members. I got voted down on that. The argument was no. The argument was that this was to be a faculty senate and that the deans were not members of the faculty. I even disagreed with that. I always thought that one of the finest elements of the Wisconsin system was the close cooperation that we always had between deans and faculty. And I wanted to encourage that, and I didn't want to build barriers between them, but I lost that one. I was very annoyed at losing it, and I still think that it would have been a good idea, since it's a very large Senate, to have the 10 deans there. I think there are about 10 deans.
They can attend and listen, can't they?
Yes, and I was going to say that it's to the credit of David Cronin, the present Letters and Science Dean, he's our most important dean, that he's always there. He sits in the back of the room, and once in a while he's called on to say something. He has the same right of any professor to speak there. But he does come. He doesn't let his pride stand in the way of his coming, and I think it's to his credit. But some deans were annoyed with the way the thing was set up and have declined to come. And I think that's unfortunate. Secondly, I thought very strongly that the Senate was too large. It has about 240 members. And
even the Senate was too large.
Yeah. The Senate as a whole is too large. Again, the faculty, people seem to be petrified over the thought that maybe they wouldn't be properly represented. And I don't know why we'd have to have a Senate which is 2.5 times the size of the United States Senate, which represents over 200 million people. But in any event, I got beat on that. And they came up with a ratio of one senator for every 10 faculty, or any major fraction thereof. And that comes to about 240 people. I think the Senate is too large and too many. It's too big a group. Too many people are overawed by the size of the group and are silent members. And it's not of a good size to exercise the functions of deliberation, in my opinion. I'd still like to see it cut down. It was there was a provision that the Senate would be reviewed after a certain number of years, and this question was canvassed, and it was clear that the faculty likes a big Senate, and it was permitted to remain the way it is, the way it was set up. The third battle I lost was over the size of the quorum. The quorum rule is a majority of all the members, and I was worried that there would be difficulties in making a quorum. When I think back at the poor attendance that we had at most faculty meetings, I was concerned that there was the possibility that meeting after meeting you wouldn't get 120 people there, and therefore you couldn't legally conduct any legal business in a lawful way. Well, on this point, my fears turned out to be unfounded. What we've all learned, is that if the members of the department designate one of their colleagues to represent them in the Senate, he feels an obligation to go. And attendance has been very good. There have been two or three occasions, this is very rare, when quorum was not present, or when a quorum was dissipated. People left because it was getting late. But I cannot honestly say that the quorum problem has been a serious problem, and I guess on that point I wanted some simple rule like 50 or 75, something less than a majority. But I think on that point I'll have to confess that maybe I was in error. But on the other two points I still regret losing the fight. But we had some very tense meetings of the faculty over these matters. Faculty were terribly afraid they were giving up precious rights, and they wanted to make sure that they would be no worse off than they were then when we set up a Senate.
How do you think they feel about it now?
I think the Senate's been a great success. And I also think that
most professors are kind of relieved that their consciences are clear. They don't have to attend a faculty meeting because they've got somebody that they elected to represent them, to do it for them.
And I can see your point that a person who is elected to do this has a responsibility to others, whereas before his responsibility was just
to himself. That's right. And attendance has been very good, and there's been no serious problem. As a matter of fact, I think the Senate saved the university from a lot of heartaches, which I'm very reluctant to discuss for any kind of a record, because we had a real cross-section of the faculty present willy-nilly, because we had a full complement of doctors. There are a lot of people in the medical faculty, mm-hmm. and engineering, and a lot of other schools, which in the old days rarely attended. Now they're there. And the university senate is an assurance that you're going to get a good cross-section of the whole faculty and its various segments and its various points of view. And without being very specific, and I'm deliberately vague on this point.
I wish
no, I'd be. I'd rather not. But I think that the very representative cross-sectional character of the Senate has saved us from an awful lot of screwball decisions that might have been made by a small group of determined people who come to a meeting early and stay late and pack the meeting to get what they want. And it's to avoid the packing of the meeting, which was my major concern in setting up a Senate, in our setting up a Senate in the first place. And without being very specific, I do think, especially during the difficult years that we had serious student problems and faculty problems, that the very cross-sectional character of the senators gave us some protection against what I regard as screwball decisions. That doesn't help much, but some old hands around here know what I'm talking about, I'm sure.
Well,
I had other assignments. I was a member of the Honors Committee of the Letters and Science College for 3 years. I served for a number of years on the Executive Committee of the College of Education. And for quite a few years, I was a member of the Micklejohn Lecture Committee. I served on it until we ran out of money.
What was that?
Well, the Micklejohn's former students, who were always proud of their experience, got some money together to pay for a lectureship, and a committee was set up to administer the money and to invite speakers to come. And I remember we had Justice Thurgood Marshall 1 year, Justice Abe Fortas 1 year, Justice Goldberg 1 year. We had some very interesting people who gave Micklejohn lectures, but it was a limited sum, and we finally ran out of money, so the committee was disbanded. Well, it was kind of fun serving on the committee and meeting these people. I served 1 year as president of the Phi Beta Kappa chapter of the university. I served 1 year, several years, as president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Association of University Professors. I took my turn as president of the University Faculty Club and served as president of the Round Table Luncheon Club 1 year. So I had a number of chores to do over the years that involved me in university's affairs. I was a member of the Faculty Senate for 4 years, and I might say that it was my idea to have a question hour. I borrowed that from the English House of Commons practice, and each faculty meeting, each Senate meeting, begins with a question period. First, questions are directed to the Chancellor. They may be written out in advance and submitted, which is the desirable thing to do so the Chancellor can prepare his answers, but anybody can get up and ask a question without warning.
This is not the same kind of material as gets onto the agenda.
No, this is outside the agenda. And then the when the Chancellor is through answering whatever questions there may be, questions may be directed to the Chairman of the University Committee. So we have a question period which starts each meeting. I think that's been very successful.
Roughly how long is this period?
It varies a great deal from one question answered in 2 minutes to questions that run for a good part of the period of the Senate sitting. It varies depending on what's up and who's doing the questioning. We also permit supplementary questions. That is, one may ask a question and then the Chancellor answers. And if the questioner doesn't like the answer or has something else to answer to ask, he can get up and put a supplementary question. The problem is to prevent that from degenerating into a debate, and that's the business of the presiding officer. And he's been advised not to permit the question period to become a debating period. It's a period for in which faculty members may get information from the head of the administrative head of the university. I'm rather proud of the concept. I think it's a good idea, and I think it's served us well.
Was this one of your ideas?
That was my own personal idea, yeah. I wrote the rules for it, too.
Well, you did?
We have some written rules, bylaws for the question period. They're in there, our rule book, I think. During my years here, I had the pleasure of serving as a lecturer in a number of universities, and this is part of my life. In 1959, I was the Brown and Haley lecturer at the College of Puget Sound. It's now
where
the,
is that?
That's in. It's just. It's just north of south of Seattle. They have a well-known lectureship, the Brown and Haley Lectureship. It was endowed by a very rich man who makes candy, the Haley family in Tacoma. And it carries a very good stipend, and the lectures are published. One of my books, called The Limits of Freedom, was the three Brown and Haley lectures that I gave in 59. I followed Merle Curdy. He preceded me by a couple of years, a long time ago now, but it was an interesting experience. And then in 1964, I gave the Bacon lectures at Boston University. And the Bacon lectureship is a very ancient and reputable lectureship. And they were published as a book on Religion and American Law, as I recall the title. And I was a visiting scholar at Western Michigan University for one period. I was a visiting scholar at the University of Houston. At Monmouth College, I was the Sperry Hutchinson lecturer. That's the Green Stamps outfit.
Oh,
Sperry,
yes.
Hutchinson lecture, University of South Carolina. And I think my last one was the Charles Dillon Hall lecture in law and government at the University of South Dakota in 1969. So I flitted about in this fashion. In my own profession of political science, I was always quite active. I was once a member of the governing council of the American Political Science Association, and in 1959 I was elected vice president of the American Political Science Association. And I was on the board of editors of the American Political Science Review. But I was also active in our regional association, the Midwest Association, and I was president of that, and that's the largest of the American regional associations in the year 1959-1960. That was a very, in 1955-1956, I was president of the Midwest Association. And then following that, in 57, I was the founding editor of the Journal
of the Midwest Association.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. That was the Midwest Journal of Political Science.
Yes, and it was renamed.
Yes.
Over my vigorous objections, a couple of years ago, it was decided that the term Midwest sounded too provincial. So it was changed to American Journal of Political Science.
Why did you object?
Well, I just didn't. I thought that Midwest described us, that it was a journal of the Midwest Association.
And how did you happen to start this? I knew you were the first editor.
I was invited by the governing board of the... it was very funny. The decision to launch a journal was made at the annual meeting of the Midwest Association in 1956 when I was presiding as president. And I was opposed to another journal. I just didn't think the profession needed one. That's another one of my mistakes. There's plenty of need for journals. We have an enormous profession and not enough outlets for publications. But though I was opposed to it, I didn't ever say I would have nothing to do with it. And when the officers and the governing board invited me to start the journal, I accepted the invitation. I thought it was an interesting challenge. So I picked its name and its format, and I had quite a time assembling enough articles for the first issue. I simply wrote letters to some 50 or 60 people around the country and asked them. Oh, yes. And I finally got enough articles together to get an issue out, and from then on it was easy. And then I was overwhelmed with articles. There were plenty of people eager to get things published.
What kind of things were published?
These are
professional
political science.
Whole spectrum of political science?
Oh, yes. It was an interesting experience. That's when I learned that if you want to make enemies rapidly, you just get yourself appointed as editor of a journal, because you have to say no to most people. You turn down most of the things that come in. And most professors think, A, that they're geniuses, and B, that they're doing you a great favor by sending you an article. And if you turn them down, that's just a sign that you're feeble-minded and or evil-minded. And in any event, you have to say no. I tried to say no as graciously as I knew how, but I couldn't possibly publish everything that came to me if they're all good. And a lot of the stuff wasn't any good at all. So it's a very demanding job, and I got it started. It's now doing very well. It has a good circulation, and it has standing as a reputable journal. And one of my most important satisfactions was getting that thing off the drawing boards and getting it into some kind of real life. But that was in 57 to 59 that I was editor, and then I was glad to get rid of it. It was a terrible time consumer. And
must have been.
Yes, I had to all work myself, and proofread everything myself. I had no secretarial help, nothing. I was reimbursed for the postage I had.
That was nice.
Had to use. I think that, and I also served on a number of committees of the American Political Science Association. I was the first chairman of the Committee on Ethics, on Professional Ethics, which was set up not too many years ago, and I served on that committee for about 5-6 years. That was an interesting assignment, and our job was to frame ethical rules in response to queries that came to us from various people around the country.
What kind of ethical rules?
I remember we drafted a rule about the submission of articles to journal, learned journals, and we said, for example, it was unethical to submit an article to a journal, to more than one journal at the same time, or to submit a manuscript to more than one publisher at the same time. Multiple submissions. We were strongly opposed to that. The misuse of the... we have a rule on the misuse of the... by the officers of the association of their positions. Use for political reasons. that we think are improper, since that isn't what their office is for. We have quite a few. I think we have about 20 formal rules now, and I recently got a restatement of them, but I was on that, and I think I had a hand in drafting most of those rules. We have a lot of ethical problems. Rule about we have some rules about tenure and I just don't remember offhand. I'd have to refresh my memory.
Well, you've given me some idea.
Yeah, we have quite a few, and I could give you the whole set. I have them here someplace. I also, over the years, I suppose my major activity was in the American Association of University Professors. I got into it almost kind of accidentally. Somebody put my name up, the nominating committee put my name up for election to the council of the AAUP. That's the governing body. They elect 10 people every year for 3-year terms. And given my background in American constitutional law, the chairman of Committee A, which is the heart of the association, the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure, the committee that makes the investigations and makes judgments about violations of academic freedom around the country, I was invited to join the committee. Robert K. Carr, the chairman of the committee, later for many years president of Oberlin College, taught constitutional law at Dartmouth. He knew me and knew my work, and I knew him, and I guess he suggested me. Since the association had to pay for the expenses of a trip to Washington for the council, and since the Committee A always meets just before the council meets, they could get me for one expense account instead of two. Oh. So they would put as many council members as possible on standing committees just to cut down on expenses. But I happened to fit this committee. So I served on Committee A beginning in 1957. Then Bob Carr, the chairman, became president of Oberlin, which made him ineligible to hold an office in AUP. And to my astonishment, because I barely knew my way around, I was asked to assume the chairmanship of Committee A, which is a very demanding job. Very demanding. Took a great deal of energy and time and heartache. But I was chairman of Committee A for 5 years. And I think that's the major position, the major function in the association.
Now, what kinds of
Committee A
came up
for? Committee A deals with complaints made by professors that they were mistreated by their administrations. And then the committee appoints
accepted principles of academic freedom and tenure. It then proposes to the annual meeting that they be put on a list of censured administrations. Censure is a form of pronouncing anathema on an institution that mistreats a professor in terms of academic freedom and tenure. And I think that even though AUP is now pretty deeply involved in trade unionism, that Committee A is still the heart of the association. That's what it's all about, academic freedom and tenure.
How do the various institutions who are censured respond to this?
Oh, they vary. Some couldn't care less, and others are very worried about it. It doesn't help a school to be, it's not really a blacklist, but it's often called a blacklist. And our censured list is widely distributed. We publish it frequently in all our publications, but so do many learned societies publish it.
The same list?
The same list, so that word gets around. Well, governing bodies begin to worry. They don't like to see their school listed as a place where it's undesirable to teach. And parents begin to wonder whether they're wasting their money sending their children to a school of which the AUP disapproves. It's a powerful moral weapon, and we know it does have, and it has an enormous impact on the president, who's usually the guilty party and who carries the onus. And you don't help the career of a young president to censure. He gets tagged as a man that's unreliable. So that, while it's only a moral weapon, it's a powerful weapon, and we exercise it with great care. But it carries a great deal of weight. Perhaps before we conclude, Let me mention a few other things that are related to what I was talking about before in connection with my activities as a member of my profession. I had a senior research Fulbright Fellowship in Great Britain for the year 1961-1962. I had an office at the London School of Economics, and I had a wonderful year in London in 61-62. Things were then inexpensive, and we could see a fine show for £1. But it was a nice... I wrote a book on English law while I was there. In the year 1957-58, I had a research award from the Fund for the Republic. That was the Hutchins outfit, and I wrote a book during that year. My book, The Defendant's Rights, came out of that year. And in the year 1959-1960, I had a research award in governmental affairs of the Social Science Research Council. And that gave me a free year. Those were my three free years. I don't want to sound boastful, but during my whole career in university teaching, I really never asked for anything. Those three grants, the Fulbright, the Social Science Research Council grant, and the Fund for the Public grant, were simply offered to me. Somebody called me or wrote to me and said, how would you like one? Maybe I'm not a very skillful at the art of grantsmanship. It's an art that I don't appreciate and don't practice, but I never sought these things. They came to me, and I was very glad to get them, but I didn't have to resort to any of the fine arts of grantsmanship in order to get them. Perhaps we might discuss next time some of my activities in the state government, which took a lot of my energies, shortened my life considerably.
Yes, I'm very interested.
All right. Well, we'll